From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Public outrage over the Enron scandal has brought campaign finance reform roaring back into the spotlight. The Senate has already acted. House legislators are now scheduled to vote next Wednesday on legislation that would rein in soft money contributions. If passed, it would mark the first major revision of campaign finance laws since the 1970s in Watergate. This hour, are we really ending the golden age of big money politics? Can Washington finally come clean? Juliette Eilpern is a reporter with The Washington Post. I asked her how strong momentum is in the House for campaign finance reform and if it's all Enron-driven.
Clearly, there's a lot of momentum for campaign finance reform. I don't think it's incredibly Enron-driven because the fact of the matter is that there has always been bipartisan support for campaign finance reform in the House, and they've passed it on two occasions.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly, it looks like at this point, the Republican leadership is at a loss of how to stop campaign finance reform. And the fact that it's already passed the Senate just raises the stakes even higher.
So is passage a slam dunk, or could things change somehow?
Things could change. There's always an amendment process, and there's a chance that there's something the Republicans could offer that would pass that would alter the bill and thereby unravel the coalition that currently exists for campaign finance reform. An alternative is that, again, they amend the bill, and then you'll have to have negotiations with the Senate, which is something everyone's trying to avoid, because if you enter negotiations, it can take months to resolve, and you also give the Republican leadership, which again opposes this bill, a stronger hand, since they get to appoint who sits on those kind of conference talks.
So either of those paths would be ways of watering down or killing campaign finance reform?
Absolutely.
In anticipation that legislation may pass, we're already hearing about soft money being stashed and quickly spent. Is that really going on?
Absolutely. I read a story about that this weekend. The Congressman Tom Davis from Virginia, a Republican who chairs their campaign arm, gave roughly $360,000 to a House member who is running for governor in Alabama. And he did this because he, in turn, is expecting that House member to then spend some of that soft money on advertisements or activities that would help a Republican candidate who will try to succeed him this fall.
So this is an effort to spend the soft money before legislation comes that may shut down that spending.
Exactly. Although this is a whole question that lawmakers are debating right now. Under the current rules, soft money contributions would be banned after 30 days of enactment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And one thing that's under negotiation is actually extending that timeline so that reform would not take effect this campaign cycle.
Juliette Eilpern, remind us how significant soft money is in campaign spending. For example, how much, what were the donations totaled last in the last election cycle from soft money?
I would say that they spent a total of $500 million, and that includes that includes the House, the Senate, and the presidential campaign committees.
Now, if the legislation passes, would all that stop then? People would no longer be permitted to give soft money donations? And if they couldn't, is there some way it can just be rerouted through some other kind of contribution?
Well, that's the argument that a number of opponents of campaign finance make. They say that this money is in the system, and if you don't allow it to go to the parties, for example, it will go to outside interest groups. People set up tax-exempt organizations that can then spend that money in a simply different way.
Is there a sense that both parties have an equal amount to lose in this reform? Both Republicans and Democrats clearly take soft money.
Yeah, it's actually a tough question, and one which I don't think there's an easy answer to. From the appearance of it, Democrats stand more to lose than Republicans in both the House and Senate. Soft money spending was a critical component in the Senate Democrats' campaign last election, and it helped them narrow the gap and eventually, obviously, win back the Senate.
And these are substantially labor union soft money donations?
They come from a whole host of places. It's not just labor unions. Mm-hmm. It's also, Hollywood, wealthy, high-tech entrepreneurs. And again, from on the House side, you can make a similar argument. If you look at how much, for example, soft money versus hard money the House Democrats currently have, I believe the ratio is something like almost 2-to-1 soft money to hard money, whereas the Republicans are in a much better shape and have more hard money donations. So that's one of the interesting questions. Why are Republicans so opposed to this bill? But, for whatever reason, they say that even if the Democrats stand to gain, they see it as antithetical to their ideals and ultimately, obviously, counterproductive from a political point of view.
To ban soft money.
Yes.
If this legislation goes through, will you feel comfortable saying that American politics has escaped the money politics brand that's been put on it in the last decade and more?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. I think it's quite reasonable to expect that this money will be diverted somewhere else, and there are always loopholes in these laws. I mean, when you think about it, this is a law aiming at fixing what was put in place in the aftermath of Watergate. So I think it would be naive to say that this will fix the problem of special interest money in politics, although some would certainly make an argument that it might curb the influence, at least in the short term.
Juliet Alperin is a reporter with The Washington Post. The Senate passed a ban on soft money contributions to political parties last spring, but House GOP leaders refused to let it come to a vote in their chamber until now. The fight's been around forever, but the Enron debacle has changed the tenor of the debate from a question of if to a question of when. Battle lines are being drawn on the House floor. Legislators are scheduled to vote next Wednesday now on the Shays-Meehan bill. Has the time come for campaign finance reform at last? And will the legislation now in motion really end the gravy train? Can reform prevent a future Enron and tilt political power back to ordinary citizens? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from Washington is John Moyers, editor and publisher of TomPaine.com. Good evening and welcome, John Moyers.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you with us. And from the studio of Vermont Public Radio is our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello. Good evening, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
John Moyers. I guess we've got the air full of talk about campaign finance reform at last. Two questions, I guess, and there's more than an easy answer to this. But number one, do you think this legislation will pass? And number two, if it does, is that the cleanup that people have been waiting for, longing for such a long time?
Well, I'm not sure about the horse race, whether it will pass or not. I think it's going to come right down to the wire. And as your first guest,
Juliet Alperin with The Washington Post. Yeah.
Yes. As she quite rightly pointed out, there are some dangers. It might pass, but depends on how it's amended. And then once it is amended, assuming it will be, and I think that's how the incumbents in the House want it to go. Once it's amended, that will require a Senate and House Conference Committee. And once that happens, as we all know, all bets are off in Conference Committee. Anything can happen. Anything often does happen. And we'll have to see what comes out of that before passing judgment on whether we like it or not.
So you're saying you don't think it will, the Shays-Meehan will sail through as currently constructed. You think they'll amend it so that it requires a Conference Committee and, as you say, anything could happen there?
I'm relying on people who know more about the legislative inside game than I do, and that's what I hear them saying, yes.
Well, then let's take what I guess would be considered at this point a best-case scenario, that somehow it wasn't amended or very lightly amended, that it came out essentially as it stands. John Moyers, you edit an online public interest journal. You've paid a lot of attention to campaign finance and where the money comes from and the influence that it holds. If it passed even unamended, untouched, unscathed, would that fix the problem?
I don't believe it does, and I think there's a very simple way to illustrate that. Among other things, the really main pillar of this law, Shays-Meehan in the House, McCain-Feingold in the Senate, it eliminates soft money from the system, or most soft money. But it's got a couple of notable loopholes. I'll come back to those in a moment.
Okay.
Soft money is important to understand that in the whole pie of money in federal politics, soft money, depending on whose numbers you rely on, are between 20% and 40%. Let's, for the sake of this conversation, call it a third. Soft money is about a third of the pie. If this bill goes through, most of that will be eliminated, leaving the other two-thirds hard money untouched, but actually not untouched because it will double the amount of hard money allowed to be given from wealthy donors. And when I –
So Shays-Meehan, it would cut out soft money essentially but double hard money, which is a bigger piece of the pie to begin with.
That's right. And so you end up basically eliminating a third of the money in federal politics, that's soft money, and then doubling the remaining two-thirds and my math says that equals 4/3.
Well, is this a good thing or a bad thing?
I don't see that as...
Soft money's been widely reviled. Is hard money better than soft money? Who contributes hard money? Is that $5 and $10 contributions, $100 contributions, or something else?
Hard money?
Yeah.
Yeah, hard money comes in mostly as $1,000 contributions, large contributions which are far beyond the reach of the average American. Something like 80% of the hard money comes in that in the form of in the last election cycle came in the form of large. $1,000 contribution.
Now somehow $1,000, it's certainly more than an average American could pull out of their budget to send off to a particular campaign. On the other hand, it seems a lot less ominous than $100,000 soft money contributions.
Well,
am I right about that or wrong?
Yes and no. Think of it this way. George Bush, when he ran for the GOP nomination in 2000, he raised something like $100 million. During the primary period.
Right.
This bill, if it were passed today, would not have touched any of that money. All of that money was hard money.
I mean, all of it was $1,000 contributions. Is this what they
talk
about?
Well, not all of it. No, not all of it was $1,000 contributions,
okay.
But most of it was $1,000 contributions. Mm-hmm. Most of it, all of that was hard money. That is to say, money that would not be touched. In fact, it would not be eliminated in this bill. It would be the ability to donate that money would be doubled. So wealthy individuals could give, you know, twice as much as they gave. So we have to pull the camera back from the small focus or the narrow focus on this particular bill and look at the problem, which is a very big problem, and say, frankly, this bill will address some aspect of that problem but leave most of the problem untouched and perhaps even make it worse.
John Moyers, in your view, what is or what has been the impact of money politics on our national life?
Well, I think it's very clear, and I think most Americans have a gut feeling or understanding of the impact of money in politics. Clearly, you can talk about it several different ways. We have two classes of constituents, of citizens in this country now when it comes to money in politics. We have the cash constituents, the 1/3 of 1% of all Americans who give 80% of all the money in federal politics.
Mm-hmm.
They get the attention of elected officials. They get service from government above and beyond what the rest of us, the mere simple constituents, get. That, I think, speaks very much to the problem. What happens, the real scandal is not Enron, although that certainly is a scandal. The real scandal is how money in politics biases government and government action to the concerns of the wealthy, the people who give, and often against the concerns of those who don't give or only give a little.
Do you think
that's the real corruption?
And will this legislation, if it goes through, change that?
I don't believe it will, because, as I said earlier, it will double the amount of money that the fat cats could give, the biggest donors. And one activist I know said that this reform, Shays, me, and McCain-Feingold, is reform that only a fat cat could love.
Jack Beatty, do you smell relief on the horizon here?
Well, I think John is getting things a little confused here, although in general I subscribe to his outlook. The total contributed is certainly going to go up. But the question with soft money is the concentration of contributions, not the total. If I'm giving $2,000, that's going to give me some attention from a corporate, from a government official. That's certainly true. But if I'm putting in $100,000 and my name is Enron, I get a hell of a lot more. So I think we need to concentrate here on the concentration of contributions that soft money uniquely allows. Yes, we're going to go up. You're going to be able to give $2,000 to a candidate. And yes, those will be bundled. That is to say, companies their executives will put them together and so on. But that still is going to dissipate the, as it were, concentrated effect of bribery that we get with corporate, direct corporate money. So I think it is a reform.
It sounds esoteric, but it's as real as cash money. We're talking about campaign finance reform. What do you think? Is the U.S. Congress bought and paid for, lock, stock, and barrel? What's it going to take to get American politics out of the clutches of big money? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
From Boston University, the
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about campaign finance reform. It's been around for years, and it's never passed. It hasn't happened since the 1970s. Now, on the wings of the Enron debacle, it looks like it may be imminent. Only today, the House is scheduled to vote for next Wednesday, where the Shays-Meehan bill will come to a vote. If that's passed, and if it's passed untouched, it could sail right to the White House, where President Bush has told the Congress he cannot guarantee a veto. It could finally happen. What do you think? How do you see big money spinning American politics? Has Enron made you a campaign finance reform firebrand? Or is soft money just a kind of free speech in your book? Is this land your land or Enron's land? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're joined tonight by John Moyers. He's editor and publisher of TomPaine.com, an online public interest journal. John Moyers, you followed this for a long time. Give us some examples from your vantage point of how you see significant ways that you see big money having influenced American legislation and politics in recent years.
Well, I think if we want to keep it in the Enron Anderson context, we could do that very easily. There was in 2000 when the former Securities and Exchange Commissioner, Mr. Leavitt, proposed some rules that would have perhaps prevented the kind of calamity we've seen with Anderson and Enron recently. Those were very firmly the Clinton administration was sort of on board with those, but when Bush came in, those went out the window.
The Clinton administration was sort of on board. That doesn't sound like a very assertive position.
Well, I think Leavitt, I think people were seeing a lot of abuse in that field, and I think it was hard not to be on board for some kind of change.
We must note that the Clinton administration in its 8 years didn't fix that. I mean, it's hard to lay it all on Bush.
Oh, no, and I wouldn't lay it all on Bush, not at all. I was just simply with that example saying that's an example of how money plays in the system, and it's not really a Democratic versus Republican problem. I mean, Enron and Anderson gave to both parties. They gave mostly to Republicans, but to both parties, really. And therein lies the rub, because there isn't anybody in Washington, hardly, who's untouched by such contributions. And we know now, as TomPaine.com a couple weeks ago ran a piece about the committees who are investigating Enron, and how almost every member of all of those committees have received at least $1,000, if not tens of thousands of dollars, from both companies. And that's the systemic corruption that prevents things from happening sometimes in Washington. We know, money in politics more often prevents things from happening in Washington than causes them to happen. Mm-hmm. That's the case with these tighter rules about conflicts of interest in the auditing industry, which eventually went down in flames under the new administration. Another example would be the telecommunications giveaway in the mid-90s. Congress rushed over. They couldn't do it fast enough. Both parties were enthusiastic about the Telecommunications Act, which has been called the greatest giveaway in modern times. Billions and billions and billions of dollars in public assets, namely broadcast spectrum, were simply given away to people who've turned around and made lots of money reselling them or exploiting them to their private interest against the public interest. Unfortunately, we could fill a show with the examples of how money influences politics.
Well, and we may. Jack Beattie, what's your view of how this has played out? What state have we come to here?
Well, I want to narrow it just for a second. The question was asked earlier, which party will this help? Which party will it hurt? And
sounds like we may have lost Jack for a moment. Jack, are you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, we've got you now.
Okay. Apparently, many Democrats were feeling that, maybe we have to take a second look at this because the Republicans outdo us in hard money. But that's not really recognizing the challenge that soft money has posed to the Democratic Party. There is nothing ideologically inconsistent with soft money corporate contributions going to the Republican Party. Republicans believe what those people, what their givers, pretty much believe. That is to say, they're not bribed. They genuinely believe in corporate priorities. That's what makes them Republicans. However, we have a Democratic Party, and that party has lost its way ideologically because of this corporate subvention. The party has lost its connection with its base. Its givers have driven policy in NAFTA, in telecommunications, again and again through the Clinton administration. The givers were driving, the donors were driving the policy rather than the base.
But Jack, let me just finish the thought, if I might. Yeah.
With soft money removed, the Democrats at least can get back, get clear ideologically and get back to their base and perhaps begin to serve their base.
Well, maybe so, but Jack, haven't some large soft money sources for the Democrats been labor unions and Hollywood, which is not famously, conservative in its views?
Yeah, but, you know, it's 11-1 corporate contributions to labor. It's important, but it just doesn't add up. And labor has made a U-turn on that. They, for years, have resisted cleaning this up, and now they recognize that was a grave mistake, and they are behind reform. And by the way, so are a lot of corporations behind reform. So we don't want to tar them all. There are a lot of corporations that say we're sick of politicians dunning us for money this way.
Jack Beattie, stand by. We've got Charles Bass on the line, Representative Republican from New Hampshire, who was one of the Republicans who stood up very recently and added his name to the discharge petition that has brought or will soon bring this legislation to the floor of the House. Good evening, Representative Bass.
Good evening. Good to be here. I just want to say from the beginning, the bill has been scheduled for debate next Wednesday.
Does that mean it will be voted on Wednesday, Congressman Bass?
Well, no. It means that we'll debate it, and I would presume, though, that we'd finish it up next week. The Speaker wants to get the bill, the issue, out of the way as soon as he possibly can, so we might be in Thursday and Friday. It all depends upon whether or not there can be some agreement between Republicans, Democrats, to limit debate on the amendments, of which there will be 20 made in order.
20 amendments. Charles Bass,
10 from the leadership, 5 from Mr. Shays, and 5 from Mr. Meehan or his designee. Mm.
Representative Bass, whatever the outcome, we want to salute you for having the kind of courage to cross party lines or at least leadership lines and sign on to the discharge petition. Earlier in this hour, I think before you came on, John Moyers has made the case that he doesn't believe that this legislation will really fix the problem. Do you?
I've been working on campaign reform now for about, 13 or 14 years when I was in the state Senate, and even in the state legislature. There is no bill that fixes everything. Campaign reform is a moving target, and you never get there. You never quite get to the goal line because the system changes. But we have a system that's been in place now roughly since the early 70s. It's basically irrelevant now, and it will be unless we pass Shays-Meehan. We'll have to fight another issue next year and the year after, but this is certainly going to make a huge difference in the temper of politics in this country.
Describe how you see that impact playing out for us, Congressman Bass.
Well, I think I heard just before I came on the discussion about soft money. I don't know who benefits and who doesn't benefit, but I can guarantee you that both parties are totally addicted to soft money, and that includes Democrats. It includes labor unions, really, who are big donors, and corporations who are big donors. To some extent, the Democrats live more on soft money, at least as a percentage of total contributions, than do Republicans. But neither side wants to – well, the Democrats want the bill to pass. The Republicans, I think, generally don't want anything to change because that keeps the status quo, which is them in the majority. I frankly don't think the campaign finance can be viewed that way. If it's good policy, pass it. We will survive as a party because we're right on the issues. And money doesn't win elections. Votes do.
Congressman Bass, how would you generally characterize the influence of soft money? Where has it pushed us? Our news analyst, Jack Beattie, says it's given American politics a more corporate face. You're a Republican. Do you agree that that's been the overall impact?
No, I think what it does is it greatly extends the ability of both labor unions and corporations to influence elections.
And what's the problem with that?
It's taken my destiny as a candidate more out of my hands and put it in the hands of people who either support or oppose me. And frankly, the people I've run against as Democrats have agreed with me on this issue, even though I've been a target more than I've been a beneficiary of soft money contributions being used to fund ads to advocate my defeat. This bill doesn't ban these advertisements. It just means that they have to be treated like they should have been treated all along when you get close to an election, and that is political ads and not education ads. And what, if you don't mention the name of the candidate, you can say anything you want.
And what's to prevent this soft money from flipping right over into the expanded hard money allowance and roaring right back into campaigns?
Fine. At least it's reported and it's documented and it's limited. Sure, there'll be more, but it's going to be a lot less than it is today. And right now we have two systems for campaigns, the system that I abide by, the political action committees abide by, and parties abide by, whereby they raise money, they file reports, and every dime is accounted for on both sides. And if you break the rules, you're in big trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But now, you know, the majority, perhaps not the majority, but a major part of all of the money that's spent on politics is spent in an entirely different arena where the reporting requirements are very vague.
The soft
and
money arena.
There really is no soft money, and there is no control. Either we go, you know, we've repealed the Federal Election Campaign Act of 1974 and just go to the Wild West again, or we make this work, and I happen to fall down on the side of making it work.
Representative Charles Bass, you've played a significant part in bringing this legislation to the floor. Handicap it for us. Do you think it will pass as it stands? Will it be amended and fall into some black hole of a joint congressional committee? What's the outcome likely to be?
Well, I think its fate is uncertain at this point. Having just said that, I think I'm optimistic about passage. The issue will be whether it goes to conference. There are going to be some amendments offered that will be accepted and will be able to be incorporated into the bill. And then there are others that will be so-called poison pills. There's going to be enormous pressure placed upon rank-and-file Republicans who support campaign finance reform to vote for any amendment that will send the bill to conference, because then, as you put it, it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
So the real challenge, I think there are more than 218 votes for final passage as the bill stands now. But the question is going to be, the debate will be a very rough and rocky, tortuous path.
We will be on the edge of our seats. Charles Bass is Republican representative from New Hampshire to the House of Representatives. Congressman Bass, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Good to be here.
We have a lot of callers who want to join us. Kaz is on the line. Welcome, Kaz. You're on the air.
Hello. That's actually Coast.
Oh, Coast, good.
I would like to say that I think the Shays Meehan and the McCain-Feingold approach to campaign reform is altogether the wrong approach, not just the soft versus hard money issue, but the whole approach of limiting contributions.
Why so? How so, Coase?
I believe that nothing that tries to attack campaign finance reform by limiting contributions can ever really be effective, because there will always be avenues for the money to be spent in such a way as to support or oppose candidates.
So what do we do?
And I think that if anyone were ever able to ever craft such a form of reform that was actually effective, then it would reach the point of being a First Amendment violation. But I think the real problem isn't that money is given. I think the real problem is that there is no avenue for a candidate who wants to run a credible campaign without accepting this kind of money to actually do so. And as a result, you'll often find that these big donors will give to both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And often the one with less money will win. But it doesn't matter. Whoever wins is beholden to this fundraising system.
Are you heading toward public finance? Is that what I hear in your voice?
That's a good part of the solution. Basically, I think all effective campaign finance reform solutions have to target providing a method for a candidate to run a credible campaign without having to be part of this particular fundraising system.
Coase, thanks for your call. Let me put that to John Moyers. John Moyers, is that the solution, a solution, public financing of campaigns around the United States, and can you see any prospect of that coming on stream?
Well, I do believe that that's the best solution. Coase is absolutely right. What she was essentially saying is you can't legislate integrity, and that's true. Right now in this country, if you feel the calling to public service, there are only two ways that you get a chance to run a campaign. One is if you're born rich like Steve Forbes.
Mm.
The other is if you're willing to sacrifice your independence and give yourself, in the public's eye at least, less independence by going out and raising money from the big special interests who have enough money to fund a campaign. What we need is what you have there in Massachusetts and in Vermont and some other places. Hmm. It's essentially public financing, clean money, campaign reform that says, hey, there's a third way a candidate can run. If they can qualify for public money, demonstrate a certain amount of support, and raise a little bit of money in small contributions, then the vast bulk of their campaign will be funded publicly.
If the state legislator will legislate the funding.
Well, they have been ordered to do so last week by the Massachusetts Supreme Court. And so we see that that's going to happen. And, you know, the beauty then is you can give candidates the choice. You don't say, hey, Steve Forbes, you're not allowed to use your own money. Nor do you say, hey, you can't go out there, Mitch McConnell, and raise his money from whoever you want to raise it from. They can both do that. However, you don't enforce those choices on candidates. You say to them, there's a third way to run. It's with this no strings attached, clean public money. And then you give candidates the choice of among those three. And then you say to the voters, you decide who's going to best represent your interests.
Here's how they did it. Who would you like? Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, I'm very disappointed with this discussion tonight. First of all, even calling this travesty a reform is absolutely false advertising.
All right, set us straight, Tom. What don't you like about it?
In addition to banning soft money, what this proposal would do would be to ban any expenditure of funds by independent expenditures within 30 days of a primary and 60 days of an election. I may have those numbers reversed, but that, to my mind, is an absolute violation of freedom of speech. And it's a real travesty. People don't realize, I mean, what this will do, basically, is give the media, and notice the Boston Globe, the New York Times, all of the big major media favor this proposal. Why? Because they will be one of the corporate interests who will be able to, you can't restrict what the radio and television stations there, they will filter, and the candidates will have very little ability to overcome. I shouldn't say very little, but they'll be restricted in their ability to overcome the mass media.
So, Tom, you see it as a clash of titans in any case, even if just media titans. And so you want Enron to be able to step up for somebody and support them against the New York Times or the Boston Globe.
Absolutely. And frankly, if anybody knows of a politician who has been bribed by let them step forward. I don't see it. Interests give money to candidates who will support their point of view.
But, Tom, don't you have any pause about the kind of influence that does buy for the big soft money contributors?
No, it doesn't bother me in the slightest. The problem is that the government has too damn much power. If the politicians are able to get these contributions because of the influence they have, and people have to protect themselves, frankly, and that's why you see these contributions, because people need to be protected.
But how about the accounting rules that were flouted in Enron's case and in other companies as well? The stock market is reeling. Don't we need some minimum level of oversight to keep our system working straight?
What we need is open disclosure. Mm-hmm. Everything should be and we now have the ability with the Internet to disclose and let the people be the judge. Mm-hmm. If a candidate takes money from interests such that people think that he's beholden to those interests, so be it. And the public will know, and they can vote accordingly. If they think that that's wrong, let them vote against that candidate.
Tom, we're hot, and we thank you for your call. We thank you, Tom. John Moyers?
Yeah, we've had disclosure for years and years and years, and we can see where we're at with that. Disclosure is important, of course. It's the basis of everything. But disclosure alone is not enough, and we know that's the case.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? 10 seconds, but freedom of speech, is it under attack here?
Well, there's a Supreme Court decision that stands like a lion in the path of real reform, the Buckley-Valeo decision of 1976, and that says money is speech.
Money is speech, and it talks loudly. You may or may not like what we're hearing from Washington. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about campaign finance reform. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about campaign finance reform. Just today, debate on the Shazmian reform legislation, now on Capitol Hill, was slated for next Wednesday. After years and years of waiting, the momentum is high, the outcome is uncertain, but the heat from Enron and the whole debacle around that has brought a lot of pressure to Capitol Hill, and folks in the know are saying there's a better chance than ever of some kind of reform being passed. What do you think? What's it going to take to get American politics out of the hands of big money? Does it worry you, or do you see the whole effort to intervene as a restriction on freedom of speech? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Chris is on the line. Welcome, Chris. You're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to say that I think this is mostly, as a couple of the callers have pointed out, a question of the willingness of politicians to bend when given money. I don't think it's a money issue as much as it is the tendency of politicians to look askance at the broad public interest and the broad and policies that would serve the public in general.
But Chris, do you think we can reasonably expect politicians who are human not to bend when big money comes into their campaign coffers?
I think any intelligent legislator can hear the arguments of people that are giving large contributions and the policies that they'd like to see in, put in place. But they can also look beyond that to what really is in the best interest of their constituencies and act accordingly. For the same reason that when a police officer stops you and wants to write you up for having a ticket, that you don't reach in your wallet and pull out a wad of cash and throw it in his face.
Mm-hmm.
People have the free will to act ethically, and this is what our politicians seem so unwilling to do.
Chris, we hope that the politicians are listening to that perspective, but the record would maybe suggest that the results are not so easily had. Chris, thanks very much for calling. John Moyers, do I hear you there?
Yeah, you know, the insidious thing about money in politics is not the individual acts of corruption or bribery or whatever that might happen, and perhaps they do. I happen to believe that most public servants are not on the take. Mm. What's insidious about the system is that anybody who makes it into office, if they're not independently wealthy, if they depend on outside contributions, has to think every step of the way, every legislation that they have to make a vote on. They have to decide, how does this affect my ability to raise money from the one-third of 1% of people who are basically going to fund my campaign? That then, over time, biases government to the interests of the donor class. That is the most insidious bit of corruption.
It's a very arresting thought in the back of one's mind. I'm sure John is on the line from Erie, Pennsylvania. John, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure. Good to have you.
Let me just pull off the road here so I don't get run over.
Pull off carefully, John.
Oh, yeah. What I see as a problem in all of the current campaign finance is that we've got a little too much government involved. I never designated a dollar of my tax dollars to go for the presidential campaign when it was only a dollar, and I've never designated when it was $3.
Now that's interesting. Why is that, John? You just thought, why not?
Well, that's tax. It says it's not my individual tax dollars going. It's somebody else's tax dollars. This is the actual government line items being spent.
So, are you saying you do not want public financing of political campaigns, John?
Right. I want it all to be private, but I would like us to take a lesson from Great Britain, where the length of campaign is very limited.
All right,
before
in time.
An election.
Yeah.
And the amount of money that can be spent is limited, depending on the level of the campaign, whether it's a presidential election or a senatorial or a local district justice.
Mm-hmm.
So you set a limit and of, say, $10 million to be spent by a certain level of candidate, and each of the candidates running for that office can spend that $10 million, and it doesn't matter where it comes from.
So you're looking for a different kind of limit here. John, drive carefully, and thank you for your call. Jack Beattie, what do you think? If we limited the duration of campaigns and the total amount that candidates could spend, would that be just as good or better a fix?
I don't think so. In Britain, they do one thing we could do, which is to have a lot more public provision of the television networks to give to free time to the candidates. We could certainly do that. The trouble with what he's saying is that I've lost my point of view here.
No, he's saying limit the time, limit the money.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I mean, it gets right into the problem of speech again, because if I'm a rich guy, why do I want to abide by some campaign limit, you know? Or if I'm Bush, I just say, wait a minute, I don't want a campaign limit. I'm gonna say no and spend as much money as I want.
But if it were the law. But if it
well,
were the
that
law.
Gets but that gets into the free speech problem,
yeah.
Doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Look, you know,
John
can
Moyers?
I address this
yes,
free
please.
Speech thing? Because I think it's a little overblown. You know, every day in meetings, town meetings, zoning meetings, select board meetings, and all the way up to Congress, we operate by rules which are a formalized way of limiting speech so that everybody can be heard. As Justice Breyer has said, the Constitution permits restrictions on the speech of some in order to prevent the few from drowning out the many. We restrict speech all the time. And I also I don't buy, you know, money is not speech. Money is property. Mm-hmm. And Buckley was wrong on that point. Buckley also said, though, that there is a way to have constitutional campaign reform, and that is along the lines of what you have there in Massachusetts, this public funding where you don't make candidates do it. You offer it to them as an option. They can still raise private money. They can still fund themselves. That's perfectly constitutional, even according to Buckley. And so this whole idea of money is speech is, I believe, a fallacy. Absolutely is a fallacy, no question about it, and we shouldn't be distracted by it. Money is not speech. Money is property.
No, I'm not disagreeing with that, but the Supreme Court says otherwise. That decision has to be reversed.
In a decision that was 5-4, it was decided with no evidence on an expedited basis,
sure,
and
that is
which
the law
many
of the
legal
land.
Scholars, including many Supreme Court scholars, believe should be reexamined, and perhaps four, if not five, members of the current Supreme Court have signaled their willingness to reexamine that very question.
John Moyers, Jack Biddy, let's get one more call. Tim is on the line from Erie, Pennsylvania. Welcome, Tim. You're on the air.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Listen, I know about this this court case, you know, briefly, that equated money to speech.
Yes.
And it's interesting that whole argument is made, and it's used by people to say that since we all have a democratic right to speech and we all have a constitutional right to speech,
mm-hmm.
you can't limit someone's money because it doesn't matter whether you're rich or poor, you still have a right to speak.
So where do you come out, Tim, and our time is short?
Well, the point I'm making is this, is obviously if there's a very small percentage of people who can put up this money, that their speech counts a whole lot more than other people's.
Mm.
And if it's a democratic principle that we all have speech, then their speech shouldn't count more than anybody else's.
Tim, we've got to go on that point. Thanks very much for your call. You know, of course, there's this issue of freedom of speech, but the influence seems unquestionable with Enron sitting in front of us and the kind of legislation that went into clearing the way for the shenanigans that went on there. John Moyers, surely this is an hour when if anything's ever going to be done, it will be now.
Well, I think you're right, and the danger in something being done now is that everybody the day after will say, we've done campaign finance reform. It's finished. It's no problem now. And that is most definitely not the case. We need to take the debate and move forward and say, how do we fund public servants with public money? Because there is an oxymoronic quality to our current situation, which can be summarized as we have privately financed public servants. And as long as that is the case, the public is not going to get the government it deserves.
Well, we'll see. John Moyers is editor and publisher of TomPaine.com. John, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thanks.
Jack Biddy, quick last word to you.
Well, I see that one of the things the Congress is considering is to make this apply to the next election, in which case they'll be like St. Augustine in the brothel, saying, save me, O Lord, only not yet.
Not yet. Well, six seats being contested this fall could change the House of Representatives, so there are big stakes there. Jack, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
For ongoing... In recent months, much attention has been paid to cultural diversity within America and to America's cultural influence on the world through globalization. In this radio diary, commentator and audio archaeologist Ned Connors has dug up some recordings to demonstrate that this cultural exchange is not a new phenomenon.
Syncretism. I came across that word in a cultural anthropology course I took years ago. I don't remember much from the course, but the word has stuck in my mind all these years. I loved the sound of the word and was intrigued by what syncretism meant. The original meaning had to do with a confederation of cities in ancient Crete, but in our time the meaning is much broader, the collision of cultures, like 19th century Hawaiians embracing the stringed instruments introduced by the Portuguese and South Americans, but finding new ways to tune them and play them as slide guitars or ukuleles. By the 1930s, we have something that few could have predicted, Hawaiian pop bands plying the exotica rooms of American hotels with songs like Hawaiian Cowboy by Al Kealoha Perry and his singing Surf Riders. Next thing we know, the Hawaiian guitar ends up in American cowboy music as an amplified electronic instrument. With stateside virtuosos like Roy Smek learning their trade from the Hawaiian wizards who played American vaudeville halls in the 20s. But who would have expected a Hawaiian steel guitar to turn up in symphonic jazz? In the mid-1920s, arrangers like Nat Shilkret were trying to dress up our national musical form. Here's a passage from Manhattan's Serenade, where he introduces a Hawaiian guitar break. This syncretism, this cultural collision, takes as many forms as there are subcultures. Phil Harris had a big hit around 1950 with Smoke, Smoke, Smoke That Cigarette.
But nicotine slaves are all the same. At a patent party or a poker game, everything must stop while they smoke that cigarette. Smoke, smoke, smoke that cigarette. Puff, 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 and if you smoke yourself to death, tell St. Peter at the Golden Gate that you hate to make him wait, but you've just got to have another cigarette. Smoke, smoke, smoke.
Here it is sung in Armenian by Guy Chakurian and his Moosh Mountaineers. Despite the fact that we were enemies just a few years earlier, the American influence in post-World War II Japan was very strong. Here's a Japanese vocalist singing her version of Patti Page's 1950 hit, Tennessee Waltz, in phonetic English.
Yes, to lost my little darling, the night he was playing the beautiful Tennessee Waltz.
We're a country of immigrants. We really don't much care what comes here. We absorb cultural forms, play around with them, and send them on their way. A surprise hit in the 1940s was Mizrlo, a song of Greek origin, but quickly paired up with Yiddish lyrics. Woody Herman and Harry James did their big band versions, and Xavier Cugat turned it into a delightful minor key merengue. Years later, in the 1950s, Dick Dale, a Lebanese kid from outside of Boston, reconceived Mizrlo as an instrumental tour de force in the California big surf guitar sound he created, quite possibly out of the plectrum style associated with the Arabic stringed instrument, the oud. As the transplanted Russian comedian Yakov Smirnov used to say, what a country.
Ned Connors lives in Barrington, Rhode Island. You can listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.